This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It's Friday, October 3rd, 2003, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It is time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning we continue our September theme of digital photography with digital camera sensor experts from Fovion. During the second half of the show, I will welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those numbers again when I invite you to participate in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Miles Elam, student of English literature and computer aficionado and programmer. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning. Morning, Lyle.
We'll start a discussion about digital camera sensors in just a moment, but first, the geek news. John.
There's a new type of thing to wave out on the internet. Ooh, how's that for you? Shocking.
No, I'm scared.
No, there's an attack program, which is different from a virus or a worm, that's attacking Internet Explorer, Microsoft's Internet Explorer. What happened is there is a site called FortuneCity.com. You go to that, there's a banner ad. The banner ad opened a pop-up window that then downloaded a malicious code onto your computer that contained a Trojan horse.
Which attacked Internet Explorer?
Well, it used a vulnerability in an Internet Explorer to install a Trojan horse on your computer.
Okay.
So it's no longer, it doesn't spread via email, it spreads via a banner ad. FortuneCity.com took it down as soon as they realized what was going on, of course. And there is a patch available. This is a patch that just came out, so you need to head up to Microsoft Update and get your Internet Explorer patched.
Yeah, just so people know, this is a relatively low security vulnerability, not because it can't do damage to your system, but rather you actually have to proactively go to a website and click
on the banner ad.
Yeah, that has been compromised in some way. It's very unusual for a website to propagate stuff like this because there's an easy way to find out where it came from.
Yeah, they said the infection, well, it's not really an infection rate since it's not a virus, but the people who were affected by this, it was very low. Since most people don't click on banner ads anyway. The interesting thing about it is it's a new delivery method that I don't believe has been exploited before.
Right. All right. Thank you very much, John, for that. Miles.
According to The New Scientist, an asteroid passed by the Earth Saturday, September 27th, and it's the closest asteroid yet to pass by that we've recorded. It's about the size of a small house, came by about 88,000 kilometers away. Now, as a point of reference, geostationary satellites are 42,000 kilometers away, and geostationary satellites are about the diameter of the Earth, five times the diameter of the Earth away. So it's about 10 times the diameter of the Earth away from us.
Wow.
Cosmic scheme, pretty close in terms of actually close. Think of how big the Earth is and how big your house is. That's how close it came.
But if you were doing this in a world situation where it was your head was the Earth, something the size of maybe a pea or smaller than that, a lot smaller than that,
mm-hmm.
went by really fast at about your height away from you. Because head is about 10 times, or body's about 10 times
I guess
height.
It's about right, yeah. Okay. Actually, it'd be close to a grain of salt.
Right, or even smaller. I mean, really, we're talking really small, but your head doesn't have billions of people on it. So
exactly.
Or yours might, Miles.
well, actually.
Well, that's a interesting story. When did this happen?
Last Saturday, September 27th.
And do we know about it beforehand or only after the fact?
No, actually it came in from within the Earth's orbit, so from sunside. So we didn't see it until it came whizzing by.
And then we went, whoa!
Hello!
All right, well, you know, eventually the Earth will be hit by these, and hopefully I'm not
Well, the Earth is hit every day by
That's it. True. But this is a big enough one where it would have actually caused a problem.
Well, it caused some damage. It wouldn't have caused a major catastrophe. Especially
a shattering event.
Yeah.
Localized damage only.
Thank you very much, Miles. John?
Well, that's enough doom and gloom for one day. There's an Italian-French company called Salvocofa that has reduced the price of solar power. They've made a new solar chip. Solar power, obviously, you have a photovoltaic cell that gets its energy from the sun. Actually convert sunlight into electricity. Right now, they cost about $4 a watt to make power. Mm-hmm. This new method will cost 20 cents a watt, which makes it cheaper than conventional power. It's instead of putting it on silicon, they're putting it on plastic film.
So does that mean it's flexible?
Yeah, it has the ability to be flexible. They can they can put it on a cell phone. It's a lot lighter.
And is it as effective as a
no.
receiver?
It's only 10% effective, whereas most current silicon-based cells are over 20% effective. So it's half as effective, but the cost, $4 versus 20 cents, the cost is worth it.
So it's cheaper, so much cheaper that you can get four times as large a solar cell.
The only reason to use silicon would be if you have a space requirement.
The 20 cents, just to be clear, that's over the lifetime of the cell.
Over the 20-year lifespan of
right.
the cell, right, yeah. 20 cents a watt generated over the lifetime of the cell. As compared to $4, which is what it is right now.
Wow. That's pretty sad, actually. Thank you very much, Sean, John, for that. Sorry about that. Miles.
The Japanese Earth Simulator is a multi-node computer cluster.
Can you say multi-node again? Sorry, go on.
That is so powerful that for modeling climate, it's able to take a granularity down to severe weather events, for example, hurricanes. So now in a simulation, the computing power is so fast that we can now chart to see year by year, if certain conditions continue, then does global warming exist? And what is the effect of global warming? For example, are we going to see more hurricanes? Or fewer,
so
or
weather
where are they going to be showing up?
Weather modeling is getting really good.
Yes.
According to NOAA this year, this is kind of related. According to NOAA, the temperature of the Atlantic Ocean has raised 1 degree, which means we're going to have the worst hurricane. They're estimating that we're going to have the worst hurricane season that we've had in 60 years, I think.
Yeah.
So that's what the effect of 1 degree of temperature increase has.
Who's NOAA? Our
NOAA's
friend NOAA?
North American...
authoritative body.
Right.
Okay. I thought you meant a friend of ours.
No. They're a large organization whose job it is. They're the guys who fly the planes into the hurricanes.
All right. Joe down the street was drinking a six pack. He was telling me that.
North American Atmospheric Association.
There is a new security problem. I ran into this at UCSC. Steve Zanoni, our expert at UCSC, sent a warning out about it yesterday. It's called Improx, and what it is a Trojan that goes on people's computers and then sends spam, and that's pretty much all it's for. Do you have this?
No. I was going to say Introx. Is that any relation?
I don't think so. This is Improx, M-P-R-O-X.
Sorry.
And it is basically what's happening at UCSC. The students came back this last week, and they all turned on their computers, and this Trojan started propagating, and the server, the whole network slowed down because all these messages were getting sent out as spam from all these individual boxes. So it's been a bit of a problem. And the thing is, it's a completely effective way to make money for a spammer to allow a lot of other people to send their mail for them, so they can send a lot more quickly and get more spam, which is always good for someone that's spamming. Miles.
Well, except for the fact that is very much under. Computer trespassing laws that are already on the books. Spamming is normally like.
That's right.
And as a public service announcement, if you get a piece of spam, do not give them money. Do not patronize them, no matter how good it is. Every time you do, you are justifying over 1 million pieces of spam to be sent to everyone else.
Right. So if you don't like spam, Never, ever, ever, ever use it. And tell everybody not to ever use it. Are we done with the news, guys?
I've got one more.
Oh, please, John.
Automaker Toyota has announced that they've been selling a car called the Prius, which currently two of the geeks own, Miles and I. And Sean has just put his order in for one. Currently, they've been selling the Prius for a loss. I'm sorry. In the past, they've been selling the Prius for a loss. They sell it for a certain amount, and it takes them a third more to make it. So they've been selling it. They've been selling it at a loss in order to get the technology out there and to get people enthusiastic about it. They've changed the way with the new model that they're making it, so that they're actually now making a profit selling the same car, well, the new model of the car for the same price. So therefore, they've proven that hybrid technology is viable and is profitable and is definitely here to stay. And they will be moving it out this month to four new vehicles.
Wonderful.
So when you go down to buy a Toyota, ask if they have the hybrid option available. It'll cost an extra amount, you know, $2,000 to $4,000 more, but you get a vehicle that's over 100 times cleaner than your average car, and it also gets much better fuel mileage.
What are we talking about?
You lie. GM and Ford have specifically stated that it's too expensive for them to make.
Okay, out of curiosity, since you both have Priuses. what's your gas mileage on this four-door sedan? Average.
Mine's sucked lately. I've only been getting like 45.
Okay.
Yeah.
I usually get about 50.
You normally get 50 miles?
In town, I've been getting around the 45 range. When I went on a recent road trip up around the U.S., I was seeing above 50. So it depends on what
you're driving. And it's a four-door sedan, and it's got pretty good pickup and all of that.
And the new one's faster.
And it's
bigger.
And it gets better gas mileage.
And it's cleaner.
And it's cleaner.
All right.
And we covet Sean.
Geeks, thank you very much for doing the news this morning. Very fun. A camera is a relatively simple device. Make a black box with a way for light to come in from one side. If designed correctly, the light coming in from the hole will be focused onto the back of the camera on some sort of image sensor. Traditionally, this sensor is a piece of paper or plastic with photosensitive chemicals on it, which change with the interaction of light. Digital cameras are fundamentally the same as traditional cameras, except that the photosensitive chemicals are replaced by a computer chip. A chip which changes with the interaction of light. So, very similar. Eric Zarkov is the Vice President of Marketing of Foveon, Inc. Foveon.com, Foveon.com, for those of you that want to look that up while we're talking. They make a new type of digital camera sensor, and Eric is on this phone with us. We'll be talking about digital camera sensors with us today on GeekSpeak. Eric, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me.
Certainly. Now, Eric, I want to talk quickly about the current state prior to the Foveon chip, what we're talking about for pickups on cameras. And what I've heard is there's CCDs, charged coupled devices.
Correct.
And then there's CMOS. And that CMOS is a little strange because that's more of a processing to make chips. So I don't understand. CCD, I kind of get. So let's first talk about CCD because that's the earlier type of pickups.
Sure.
And
I think before I go into some detail about that, I think that it's interesting to know a bit about the chip technologies in the history, but also would like to get to why, what is the real important thing about an image sensor when it comes time to purchasing a camera. But let's go into the history a bit first. CCDs were invented probably more than 30 years ago, and it stands for a charge coupled device. The difference between CCDs and CMOS let's first talk about the things that are common.
Okay.
Both devices are made out of silicon. Both have what's called photosites, which are locations on a two-dimensional grid that have something called a photodiode. And what happens in a photodiode is that when light strikes the silicon and the photons reach the photodiode, the photodiode converts the photons into electrons. And the number of electrons collected at each site is proportional to the light intensity. So in other words, you could think about an image sensor as being a two-dimensional grid of buckets. And you could think of photons as being rain. So as the light is raining down on top of the buckets, when they fill up, the amount of water or light that's in each bucket represents how much light intensity there is.
That's a good metaphor. Let me talk real quick about the actual photodiode. It's interesting to note that photodiodes are actually electrically, symbolically, and everything almost identical to an LED, a light emitting diode. And really, if you throw all photodiodes, they're actually kind of reversible devices. LED is not designed specifically for picking up light, but you could use an LED and actually pick up light with it. So they're kind of, they have this interaction. And we see LEDs everywhere now. There's little, you know, laser pointer LEDs
Sure. Kind
of all over the place.
Sure.
This whole concept of exciting electrons off of a plate or picking up electrons and changing that into electricity is really common now. We're getting really good at it. And that's how the emerging of the CCD is. But the thing with the CCD is, if you're talking about a 6-megapixel camera, you're talking about more than six billion of these things.
Six million sites.
Million sites. You're talking about actually more of that. And we'll get into that about color in a minute. But
sure.
So that, now that's both the CMOS has these things and also a CCD has.
Right. So fundamentally, what's common is that, you know, both are pieces of silicon. Both have photodiodes that convert photons into electrons. Where they differ is they differ in how the silicon is made, how the actual sensor device is made. CCDs, and the difference has to do with both the materials, the starting materials that are put into the fab to manufacture the parts, and they also differ in the particular formula that's used to actually build up the image sensor. So with CCDs, what's happened, in not being an electrical engineer, I'm going to quickly hit my boundaries in terms of explaining the
That's fine.
The finer parts of the process methodology. But what's important to know from a pragmatic point of view is that CCDs are a specialized process. The fabs that make CCDs are specialized, and they only make CCD parts. They don't make anything else.
So what you're saying is the whole process of actually taking the silicon wafer and doing the whole process to make chips on it for CCDs is a very specific type, and basically the whole plant is designed around a CCD manufacturing.
Right. And if you look at the number of CCD chips that are made per year in comparison to the number of microprocessors and DRAM and traditional computer chips that are made in a year, the number of CCD chips is infinitesimally small. Proportionally. So what has happened is that the infrastructure that's been built to build CCDs has pretty much stopped. There, you know, there's no new fabs being built to make CCDs, while CMOS process, CMOS image sensors use the exact same fabs that the rest of the world's computer chips are made in.
So the reason why we hear CMOS all the time is that it's a really common way to make chips.
Exactly.
And it's basically the process of creating the chip is what CMOS is.
Yeah, CMOS describes the process, the methodology, and the characteristics around that, the starting materials.
The electrical characteristics as
sure.
well, to some degree.
Right. Uh-huh. And so there are a lot of advantages. There's advantages to both architectures in terms of the building of the actual sensor. But fundamentally, the fact that, I mean, to give you an idea, I think 2 years ago, $50 billion was spent in building, updating the infrastructure of CMOS devices. So there's a tremendous, I mean, the entire computing chip industry is constantly squeaking, you know, every bit of optimization they can out of it, whereas CCDs has been flat. So the rate of innovation, the rate of efficiency in CMOS is so much higher than in CCD that it just becomes much less expensive to produce CMOS-based parts.
That makes sense. And all the R&D effort basically is going into CMOS, so stay in that realm.
Exactly. Right.
So when we talk about CMOS pickups, we're basically saying, well, CMOS has accelerated so much that there's now that same type of light-emitting or light-receiving diode as there is in the CCD process.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say it's exactly the same,
right.
but the ability to capture the light and produce, pictures for digital cameras is emerging.
Right.
And you have to look at this in the context of time. I mean, as I mentioned, CCDs have been around between 30 and 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
CMOS sensors in consumer digital cameras have really just started. I mean, CMOS sensors up until a couple of years ago were only found in toy cameras and Barbie cams and things like that.
Because they just weren't good enough quality.
The quality's not good enough, exactly.
I know that we're going to probably run into our technical limitations here, but of our understanding. But the CCD, the charge coupled device, is basically going, there's a small capacitor next to that light emitting diode, and photons hit the diode. One photon won't actually produce enough charge on that capacitor to detect, but a lot will. So basically, the amount of sensitivity is determined from that design of the CCD. And so all these little capacitors are charged up when you submit light onto it. So not necessarily a shutter on there, but you get ready to receive the image, and all the capacitors fill up with photon energy. Photons and get transferred into electricity by these little diodes, and then the little capacitors get charged, and then you have to scan the whole thing to read the capacitor charges. And that's like part of the mechanics of getting the actual reading off of that.
Right. And so the readout structure for CCDs, as I mentioned before, is like a bucket brigade. So if you imagine you have this two-dimensional array of buckets that have filled up with electrons, to read them off the chip, what that process is that basically the charge is transferred from one bucket to the next one in the same row, all the way down to the side of the array, and then it's read out serially there. So it really is a bucket brigade type of readout.
Mm-hmm.
That you're transferring charge from one location to the next.
You read the first one on the side, and then you move all of them over, and then you read the next one, and so on.
Right.
And
so
it takes a long time to read a million or 3 million.
Or 3 million or 6 million, exactly.
Right.
And you also don't get the ability to read out just a portion of the sensor, for example. So if you, and there's some very interesting applications that do that. So if you just want to read out part of the sensor, you can't. You have to read out the entire array into memory, and then from memory you subset the readout for part of the image.
So I'm assuming then that CMOS is different.
Well, CMOS, it's like reading RAM. You have an XY, you specify an XY location, and you can read out any one pixel location.
So you don't have to move the charges over.
Correct.
Okay, does that mean that there's still some kind of storing of that photo light, or do you have to do that fast enough to actually grab the image?
Well, at a certain point, you do have to read it out within a certain point before the electrons dissipate. So there is some time sensitivity there. But in the cameras that we make, you can have exposures up to 15 seconds. I mean, you collect more noise the longer you wait.
Right.
So the image will have some deterioration to it.
Okay. All right. Well, I do want to get into the Foveon chip because it's very different. But without us talking about the basics, no one will understand why it's different. So let's go ahead now get into both the CCD and the CMOS. They still don't. If it's a 6 megapixel camera, it's 6 pixel representations on the camera. But in reality, on like the CCD and the CMOS, the more traditional digital format before the Foveon, color plays a big complication in this
right.
piece. So can you describe that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Foveon X3 sensor is really a new class of image sensor. We actually the category that describes it is a direct image sensor. If you look at all of the existing CMOS and CCD image sensors today, they actually only capture 1/3 of the light. So if you think about the problem of how to capture color, the image sensors that, when they come off the fab, are inherently monochromatic. In other words, the image sensor itself only detects the absence or presence of light.
Then how does it do the coloring?
The way color is accomplished in digital cameras and point-and-shoot digital cameras is that on top of the sensor matrix, very, very, very tiny optical color filters are placed on top of each pixel.
So gels.
So they're gels. It's a organic plastic that is spun on through a photo etch process. So the way you can imagine it is, I usually describe it as a three color checkerboard. So imagine making a three color checkerboard and making it onto some sort of transparency material, and then putting that up to the light to your eyes, and look at the world through that checkerboard. That is actually what the sensor is seeing. So every single location on the sensor is only seeing red, or it's seeing blue, or it's seeing green, but it's not seeing all three colors.
Let me ask you, I heard that on those, lots of times there's two green cells for every one blue and red.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because the green light has some kind of difficulty getting to the sensor or something?
No, actually that's a very interesting question. So when I talk about this three-color checkerboard, when I say that, there's lots of different patterns you could make with three colors in a checkerboard. The pattern that is most common is called the Bayer pattern, and it was invented by Dr. Bayer at Kodak some 30 years ago. And the way that pattern looks is if you kind of zoom in onto this onto the sensor and you look at a 2x2 matrix of pixels, what you'll have is you'll have a green filter in the left. To the right of it, you would have a blue. Underneath the blue, you would have another green, and then to the left of the green, you would have a red. So, in other words, in four pixels, you would have two green filters, and then you would have a red and a blue.
Now, is there a reason for that?
Yeah, there is. And what it turns out is, if you look at the sensitivity of the human eye, if you look at the spectrum of light, ranging from the entire spectrum of colors, the human eye is most sensitive to green wavelengths of light. It's just how we're made.
Because it's right smack dab in the middle of what we can see.
Exactly. And so with green being the most sensitive color that we perceive, the decision in designing a color filter for digital cameras, it turns out that that's how you get the most sharpness. And so the pattern was chosen to optimize the amount of sharpness that you see, the amount of luminance information that you see, and bias it towards green, so that you can maximize the representation in the sensor.
Okay, so now that's a standard.
Wait a second, actually, John. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate, from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John and Miles, and via phone is our guest, Eric Zarkoff, Vice President of Marketing of Foveon, Inc. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL and spam filters, and for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301.
I have an announcement here about a group called Third Break. Let me read you their mission statement. Santa Cruz Third Break is a not-for-profit profit object to develop a community broadband wireless network in the Monterey Bay region. The use of inexpensive, widely available, and user-friendly equipment makes it possible for a network to grow from the grassroots level, based almost entirely on a wonderful combination of self-interest and community spirit. Basically, their plan is to create a wireless hot zone, meaning you can access it wirelessly for free, since they're not-for-profit. In Santa Cruz,
and then spread out from there.
Downtown and east side. The downtown section will cover an area boxed in by Water Street, Front Street, Laurel Street, and Center Streets. Connectivity to the internet may require users to sign up for an ISP account, but it's hoped that some level of free access will be available.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
They have a meeting. Their first meeting is Wednesday, October 22nd, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and it's at 742 North Brentsford 40 Avenue in Santa Cruz.
And you can learn more information if you'd like by calling 476-2800 and calling in and asking about that. Earlier in today's program, we talked about some news about oceanographic information, weather sensing stuff, and John mentioned NOAA, N-O-A-A, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Association. And a caller wanted to let us know that they're located in Monterey, and that's their name. Thanks for calling in. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell, and you are listening to Geek Speak. We're going to continue our discussion, and then we'll be opening the calls up pretty soon, but I want to get into the Foveon chip. So, Eric, what's the problem with Eric Zarkoff, Vice President of Marketing at Foveon? Eric, what's the problem with these traditional matrices of colors where you have this pattern going on?
The problem is that, with these color filters, is that you're blocking out two-thirds of the light. So when you have a red color filter over a pixel, the blue light and the green light actually gets blocked out from being sensed by the location underneath. So as a result, you're left with this what's called a mosaic of information. And to reconstruct what the full color of the scene was, you have to go through a very complex process of color interpolation. And basically what happens is if I kind of switch my framework here, and you think that if I'm standing on this matrix of sensors, and I'm standing on a blue square, and there's different colored filters around me, if I'm sensing blue information only, I need to find out how much green and red information was also supposed to strike this one spot. Not knowing that, I have to ask all my neighbors. And so a blue pixel has to ask the adjacent red pixels how much light fell on each of one of them, and based on determining how far away it was and how much intensity, then it estimates how much red light fell on it. Then it has to go through the same process for green. So the images that you get from digital cameras today are actually made up of two-thirds of information is guessed at. And the result is that you end up with color artifacts. You end up with sort of a rainbow type effect on fine lines that can be disturbing when you look at them because they're not part of the natural scene. What manufacturers do to get rid of those artifacts is they blur them. So having created artifacts to try to make up all the right color, then they apply what's called a blur filter to kind of smudge away the artifacts that can appear on edges and try to minimize that.
Well, okay, let me ask you real quick, because I'm really curious about this. We're talking about this big matrix of pixels, and we talk about 3 megapixel and 5 megapixel and 6 megapixel
right.
cameras. When a company says this is a 6 megapixel camera, are they saying that there's 6 locations of 3 colors or 6 individual pixels?
No, that's a great question. What they're saying is that in a 6 megapixel camera with current technology, they're saying there's 6 million locations that sense light.
And one-third of those are red, one-third of those are blue.
It turns out that 50% of those locations are green.
Okay.
And that 25% are blue and 25% are red.
Because everybody's using that same filter.
Right.
Okay. So that means that the image on a 6-megapixel camera, the traditional sensor, it really is, a lot of it is created by software.
Correct.
Kind of figuring it out.
By looking at its neighbors, right.
And when you say that metaphor that you stand on the square and you ask your neighbors, what's really happening is there's some software program that does that.
Yes, I'll just use that as an example,
and,
right.
And is that in the chip?
No, that's actually in a supporting chip, a DSP that is an image processing chip. And to give you a sense of how complex this gets, it's been publicly estimated by some of the larger manufacturers that it takes about 100 calculations per pixel to reconstruct the color by looking at all the neighbors. So when you look at, you know, a 1-megapixel type of image sensor, you're talking about 100 million calculations that take place. And a 1-megapixel, you know, image is a fairly low-resolution image. So there's a lot of horsepower that has to be put behind reconstruction and then softening, correcting for the mistakes. And so you end up with a picture that is not nearly what it could be if it was captured correctly.
So taking that foveon trip example where you have the semi-transparent layers, that's my understanding so far.
So with the foveon X3 technology?
Yeah.
Yes, let me explain what that is. The foveon X3 technology directly captures light. What we've been able to do is we've been able to embed photodetectors in a stacked manner, knowing that silicon actually, it turns out it's just a fluke of nature that if you shine a white light on top of a thin piece of silicon, the silicon is a natural color separator. The blue light is absorbed into silicon near the surface of the silicon. Green light is absorbed a little bit farther down, and red light is absorbed farther down still. And that's actually a property that's utilized by solar collectors, which is something you talked about earlier. So knowing that property, what we've been able to do is embed photodetectors at 3 different levels in a particular site. So when light shines onto a foveon X3 sensor, we capture the red, green, and blue light for each location.
Okay, so instead of filtering out and saying remove two-thirds of the light for this pixel, so I'm only seeing the red, you're instead saying
we capture all of it.
All of it.
Right.
Okay.
And so the amount of information that we capture per unit of silicon is extremely high.
Okay, miles.
Now, in the mosaic pattern, you have 50% are green and then 25% are blue and red, respectively. With the foveon, I'm looking at your webpage right now, and it has the blue layer up on top, the green layer in the middle, the
right.
red layer sandwiched underneath. And what I'm wondering is, you only have one green layer. So
mm-hmm.
the talk about mosaic patterns and having twice as many green sensors, how does that fit in? Do you have a twice as sensitive green layer, or?
No, actually, the sensitivity in terms of the photons that we collect, there's it's actually not the way I would describe this. I think what you're asking for is how does the green sensitivity compare to a Bayer pattern? And what it means is that for the same size silicon, if we compare a Foveon X3 sensor with a CCD using color filter arrays, we capture for the same size and the same number of pixel locations, we capture twice as much green as the CCD will.
Even the CCD has, because really every location you have a green sensor.
Right.
And only 50% of the
correct
other ones have
a
green sensor.
It seems like on the Mosaic sensor, they had to make a choice of,
how do you bias it? How do you bias your choice?
Right. Exactly.
And basically, because if you can't really do an average three, you have to do something that you can matrices. So they did four pixels and chose which colors to do. I want to go ahead at this point now and open up our phone lines for people to call in, ask digital camera sensor questions specifically.
Sure. Can I just make one more comment before
please,
you do?
Please.
So in terms of what that means in terms of us having 100% green, what that means is that for the same number of locations, you will easily see the Foveon X3 sensor will be at least twice as sharp as its counterpart.
Okay, we'll get into that some more. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. That's toll-free number in California only. Again, the phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. John, you have a question?
And we must apologize right now. Our email is currently down. We have to have it up by next show.
Thank you. That's true. We do not have – the geeks are not geeking this week. Eric, we are on the phone with Eric Zarkov, Vice President of Marketing of Foveon, Inc., and you can learn more about Foveon at www.foveon.com. They've got some great slide examples of how their technology differs and how it works, pretty much what our discussion has been so far. Now, Eric, let's talk about the image sharpness that you're talking about. Now, in the matrixy type with the filter, you have to blur it to get rid of some of these artifacts.
Correct.
Do you have those same artifacts?
No, we don't, because those artifacts arise when the software that's doing the interpolation gets confused as to what a color value should be. With our sensors, since we detect all the color at every single location, we know exactly how much color is at each point. So the artifacts don't arise, and therefore we don't have to correct for them and blur them out.
So will this speed up the response time? Because I know that's a big issue in digital cameras. When you take a picture, how much time does it take before you can take the next picture?
Yeah, the startup time. Yeah, the startup time is actually a function of it has a lot to do with the CCD architectures.
When you say startup time, do you mean the camera powering up time? Or
exactly.
I think what you're talking about is between
pictures. Photographs.
Like if I want to take two pictures quickly.
That's actually more of a system problem in which includes image processing. And so you're right. The larger your array is, the more complex image processing is, the more you have to have a more powerful DSP to do all this munging to store it off. And so there's different strategies of dealing with that. One strategy is that you put a bigger and bigger horsepower DSP in there to do the processing as much as you can in real time. Another option is that you just create a big buffer and take as many pictures as you can, capturing the raw information, and then where there's a pause in the picture taking, then you do the image processing,
which takes a long time because it's 100 per pixel basically of processing time.
Correct.
So what about the Foveon? Do you have to do a lot of that processing or different?
No, we don't have to do the color interpolation at all, which has a lot of benefits. It means we can use a less powerful DSP, which draws less power, which costs less money. And you get images that are stunningly sharp.
Well, we've got a call from Joe in Santa Cruz. Joe, welcome to Geekspeak. Joe, can you get us today? I guess we don't have Joe. Do we still have Eric?
I'm right here.
Oh, good. Well, we didn't have Joe, but Joe's question was, what current cameras on the market have the Foveon technology?
The camera that's on the market today is the Sigma ST9. Sigma is probably most known for providing aftermarket lenses for SLR cameras for Canon, Nikon, Minolta.
SLR stands for?
Single lens reflex. These are the cameras that that have typically have interchangeable lenses. They introduced the SD9 camera last February, and that camera has a 10.2 million pixel sensor in it from Foveon.
All right, so that's the only camera currently on the market.
That's right.
When did you release your chip? When did you release the first Foveon chip?
That first product was announced at the same time. So we released the chip, and that product came to market at the same time.
And we're talking about months?
I'm not sure what your question is.
How long ago did the camera and the chip come out?
Oh, the camera was announced in February 2002.
Okay, so you've been around for a while.
The company's been around for about 5 years. And we had, you know, there's an earlier part of our business that was focusing on producing portrait cameras. Uh-huh. We've shifted our business to focus on image sensors. And what you're going to see, I mean, there's other aspects and benefits of the Foveon chip that I haven't mentioned.
Okay, well, let's get into that. I'm going to take a call right now from Harold of Santa Cruz. Harold, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
The question has to do with the depth at which the different frequencies get collected. Is there a correction that needs to be applied because red is the last one and the other colors are up higher? In other words, do you lose intensity and have to correct back for that just because of the natural attrition effect of the square law or whatever it is that's causing the colors to be collected at different depths?
Yes, I think I understand the question. If I can paraphrase, what I think you're asking is because the light has to pass through the photon, the red photons pass through more silicon, is there an attrition there, and how are the color curves compensated for the collection of photons at different depths?
Is that right? Is that right, Harold?
Yeah, that's exactly the question.
Okay, please, Eric. Can
okay. The way that we show the illustration on our website, and the way I've described it, is pretty high level. I mean, we have pretty clear lines between the blue, green, and red layers. The reality, in fact, is that it isn't sharp cutoffs. There is some overlap. So you'll have some blue photons that will kind of mingle into the green area. You'll have some red photons that will be in there as well. But the majority of the separation occurs as indicated. So then the question is, how do you compensate for that overlap that happens? There is overlap in the color curves, and that's something that we've applied some image processing to do to correct for that. It is something that occurs. It's not so much the intensity, but it has to do more with the getting cleaner color curves.
I'm going to take a guess here, Harold and Eric, please correct me, that the way that the light is actually separated out into different zones is that the frequency of light is different. And so the frequency, actually, they're able to avoid each other. So the very fast frequency or very high frequency stuff is more reflective, if you will. So it's going to stop quicker. And it's just like in our atmosphere, the sky is blue for the same type of reason.
Right.
That the interaction of blue light happens faster to molecules in our atmosphere, and so blue light gets scattered before any other light, and therefore you have a blue sky. So, and when you have a long time for scattering to take effect, the blue and the green get scattered, and then the red gets scattered, and that's why you get the sunset on the horizon, because the light is traveling a long way through the atmosphere, and eventually you get that scattering. So you can think of this chip technology as the same thing as our atmosphere. Blue light gets separated first, and then the more atmosphere you go through, the different frequency of the light gets scattered or hit molecules, which then pick up the light. Is that right, Eric?
Yeah, I think that's essentially what's going on.
Cool. So the answer to the question is, why is the sky blue? I love it. Howard, did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much. We're going to go right to Dennis Las Lomas. Dennis, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi. Can you go ahead and speak up as loud as you can?
Yeah. Are you hearing me now?
Barely, but go on.
Just a moment.
Go ahead and do your question. We'll figure it out.
Okay. Well, I work in the dental field, and we've, in the past 10 years, started using a modified charge coupling device for imaging x-rays rather than film. And at this point, we're charging the dentist about $5,000 and $7,000 for each sensor they buy, and right now they're based on the charge coupling device you spoke of earlier, and you mentioned that it is now CMOS. imagers coming out?
Yes.
Okay.
So when will that hit the X-raying industry?
Well, the thing is, they buy off-the-shelf devices and modify them. and you know, the more of something that's available, the price comes down. Are they starting to incorporate the CMOS more into digital cameras now?
Yes. CMOS is starting to take over for CCD and cameras, mostly because it's a cheaper process and the quality is the same. Now, whether that will actually happen in the medical field soon, of course, comes down to the medical industry being a little slower on technology to make it safer. But, Eric, do you have more information on
that? Yeah, I'd like to actually comment on that. And this actually gets back to what I think is actually the more relevant issue around this. In the medical field, well, first of all, I believe that the charge couple devices used for X-rays are modified.
Yeah, they have a fluorescent screen attached to them, which usually is used in conjunction with a fiber optic bundle that's machined to the surface of the charge coupling device. And something about your technology is interesting. I was wondering if your company could find a way to incorporate a fluorescent layer into the chip so that they could just eliminate the fiber optic bundle and the fluorescent
right.
screen.
And the reason for this, by the way, let's get back to this reason for everybody that's listening. X-rays are such a high frequency that the emitter receivers, the photosensitive diodes, don't really pick them up.
They
so what you have to do instead is change that X-ray. You have to excite something else that then produces something that's closer to visible light. So you put a photofluorescent film on there. You hit that with X-rays. The photofluorescent film glows, and then you're able to pick it up with the sensor. So the question is, can you just put one of those things right on the chip layer, and then the chip can pick up X-rays?
Yeah, and so I guess my response is I don't know about that possibility. I know that right now our focus as a company is primarily aimed towards consumer applications, not the medical field or a lot of specialized vertical applications.
You're going for where the money is.
We have to. I mean, we're venture funded. But with that also, I want to make a comment in terms of the medical applications, because there was a lot of interest in our technology about medical applications for microscopy and others. And our technology has a very distinct advantage there, because when you're looking at blood cells and you're trying to look at very fine detail where there's dyes are used to code particular structures within the cells, you can't afford to have color artifacts. If you have color artifacts that cause a misread on the diagnosis, that's a real problem. And so we've actually been fielding a lot of inquiries for microscopy and other medical applications because of our color accuracy. We've also, I mean, ironically, have also gotten a lot of inquiries from law enforcement for the same reason, because in trials there are experts that go on and talk about the inaccuracies
effect.
And
sure.
The inaccuracies of current digital cameras, and that two-thirds of the information is being made up.
Right,
and
right. So they try to dissuade the jury by going
exactly.
Stable. So your chip might be able to make it a little more. Harder to make that argument.
Yes, and let me just tie back to the gentleman's question also, in that our multi-layered structure for capturing color, there are other ways that we can use layers for different applications that we're not prepared to talk about. But there are the layered structure is actually, we believe, is going to be the replacement technology for image sensing.
Dennis, thank you very much for your call.
Real quick, what was the name of his company again?
It's Fovion.com.
F-P-H or F-O?
F-O.
Fovion.
Fovion, F-O-V-E-O-N .com is the great place to see that out. And we're going right back to another call. Scott and Aptos. Scott, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
I was wondering, Eric mentioned something about 10.2 or 10 million pixels, or I'm not sure exactly what the phrase was, but I'm curious, what size file do you end up with?
Ah, that's a great question. The SD9 camera has 10.2 million photodetectors, which are stacked, so the number of locations that you have actually is around 3.4 million locations. So the file size in the SD9 camera for a high-res picture is around 8 megabytes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And
so what's equivalent to on the from megapixels with regards to file size from other cameras?
That'd
well,
be like a little under 3.
I'm sorry. What was the last comment?
It would be equivalent to like a about a 3 megapixel traditional.
Well, no, I'd say this is actually a very interesting area because with the ST9, it has 10.2 million color pixels. The way you'll see that when you open up Photoshop, you'll actually see a file that is a 3-megapixel file. But what you're getting is the red, green, and blue values are real captured values. They're not interpolated.
And there's no blurring that's needed.
Exactly. So, you know, so what you're going to get, even though it's a smaller file, you're going to get incredible amount of detail.
You know, it's interesting. Until I talked to you or talked to someone about this a week ago or so, I didn't understand why when I take my digital camera and zoom into it. Normally, if you scan something and you zoom into it, you have really clear definitions of pixel changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a grain that's the size of the pixel or close to it, you see when that happens. But with my digital camera, you don't see that same kind of thing.
And that's exactly why.
You see the kind of blurring effect. You look at a line, you see that there's
right.
It's blurred over a few pixels. So in yours, I'm assuming you don't see that blur.
No, and if you look at our sample pictures, I mean, you'll zoom into, you know, hairs on you know, fine hairs that are on someone's head, and you'll see the nice sharp curve of that. So what's happened is that in digital cameras today, people have gotten used to the fact that the industry has been throwing a lot of pixels at the problem, but you're not really getting your money's worth. I mean, you're actually getting cheated out of 2/3 of the potential.
So Eric, since you work for Foveon, I know it's going to be biased to some degree, but what do you think if you look at a Foveon picture versus your that camera you're talking about, which is 10.2 million color sensors, which is equivalent in size to a 3.4 million locations camera. If you look at that compared to like a traditional digital 6-megapixel, what do you think?
Oh, it's not just even a biased opinion. It's categorically better.
Okay.
It is. I mean, you can take blind tests.
Uh-huh.
Would
that translate to then, say when I'm printing up a file, say if I'm using another digital camera and I want to print a file like that at 200 pixels per inch because that's what I need for sharpness. Are you thinking with a Foveon chip, say you could go down to like a 150 pixels per inch and get a similar sharpness?
What I can tell you is that we routinely go to trade shows and industry shows. And in fact, I'm looking right now at a 30-inch by 40-inch print of a portrait, and you can see fine hairs. You can go, you know, within five inches of viewing it, which is far closer than the standard viewing distance. And the picture is incredibly sharp. Our pictures get very close to the quality of medium format film.
And Scott, to answer your question, you would still want to have the same resolution set to print it to output it, because that has to do with how many pixels you're laying down. But theoretically, the image quality of the laydown will be a better image. It won't have a slight blur effect on it. So therefore, the output quality would be better even at the same resolution. That's generally what we're talking about. Scott, thank you very much for the call. We're going to take our next call from Tom and Bonnie Doon. Welcome, Tom, to Geek Speak.
Hi there. Very interesting program. And my question is, I'd like a comparison of the low light sensitivity of the Foveon chip compared to other similar cameras of equal resolution. For instance, if I have a camera and I set it for an ASA 400 reading or ASA 800 reading, you're going to get a lot of noise in the shadows. And I was wondering if the Foveon gets around that. And number two is I was wondering about the price of the camera with a Foveon chip and what do you predict on its future price trends, whether they'll come down to be within the amateur range or not. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Okay, sure. So the first question regarding noise, the same phenomenon that occurs in film, that occurs in CCDs, also occurs in our sensors. So if the scene is light starved and you're not getting enough light in and the exposure time is long, yes, there is going to be more perceptible noise or grain visibility in the image. The ST9 camera goes up to an ISO 400, and we've actually made some very significant improvements on that recently that will be seen in the upcoming announcement. So noise is always a challenge. It's a constant discussion that we deal with every day. But we have made some pretty big changes there.
Now, isn't it so that your chip actually picks up a lot more light? I mean, it's not just burned up in the gel patterns that remove some of the light. So doesn't that kind of compensate for it?
Well, there's a trade-off, because on one hand, since we have three photodetectors and we capture all of the light that hits any one spot, increases the efficiency and therefore reduces noise. On the other hand, there is some of the space is taken up in the pixel for the transistors for readout. And so, you know, if you look at the size of the pixel, what percent of the pixel area is receiving light versus what percent of the pixel is transistors, that is going to be smaller than what you see on a CCD. So, you know, it's kind of like we gain some and we lose some. But overall, what we're seeing now is that we're actually completely comparable.
All right.
In this next generation we're coming.
Well, this program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. Eric Zuckoff is the Vice President of Marketing of Foveon, Inc. You can learn more about Foveon at www.foveon.com. Foveon.com, and the one camera is a link from there to figure to the camera that's actually supplied with that chip is a link from there. Eric, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak here today with us.
I really enjoyed it. Wish there was more time. There's a lot more to talk about.
Me too. Thank you.
Okay.
The geeks this morning were Miles Elam and John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you for participating in GeekSpeak, geeks.
Always.
To those that called in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? This show concludes our September and a little bit of October discussion about digital photography. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Coming up right now is Fine Print.